and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Joining me on the show today is Datuk Dr. Johan Arifin Samad. He is the former CEO of the Institute for Development Studies, which is a Sabah government think tank. He is also an opinion writer. He has written for a long time for many news portals under the pen name Joe Samad. And he has just recently published a compilation of his writings in a book titled Unequal Partners, Race, Religion, Domination and Inequality in East Malaysia. Dr. Johan, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. It's good
thank
of you,
Melissa,
to be sharing this book with me today. I'm hoping to discuss more about the book. But let's talk a little bit about the timing of this book. You're launching it on the 60th anniversary of the independence of Sarawak. In the title of the book, it's coming at a time where the headline message from the top is that we should avoid sensitive and provocative topics of the 3R, persuasion, race, religion, and royalty. And in your title, you have two out of the three R's.
You're very observant.
Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yes.
This must have been a deliberate choice to talk about race and religion. Why have you decided that this is the time to do so in a book, published in a book, which is very different from writing an opinion piece or making comments online? Why do you think it's important that we have these conversations?
I think, first of all, most Malaysians do not realise that this year is the 60th anniversary of Malaysia's founding. Okay? Malaysia was born on September 16, 1963. So this year is very significant. But as I can see, the government does not talk about it. Okay? There's no pre-planned celebration programs that I can see. I mean, if there is, they should be preparing now.
Well, they're busy with the state elections.
Oh, yes, of course. That too. So it's a pity because Peninsula Malaysians, sometimes we call them Malayans, but that is not offensive, but it's just a short
term. Shorthand, yes.
Shorthand. So the people here don't realise that Malaysia actually started on September 16, 1963. It's not Merdeka 31st August 1957. So a lot of younger generation especially are not aware of it because it's not taught in schools in a proper historical perspective. Okay, this is what East Malaysians always complaining, that you know, the history has been twisted and hidden under all this Malacca Sultanate and so on. But the history of how the country was formed through an agreement which is called Malaysia Agreement 1963, and it was signed between Great Britain, Ireland, Singapore, Malaya then, of 11 federated states, and then Sabah and Sarawak. So that is how we were formed as a country, through an agreement, all right? Unlike other countries, through revolution, freedom, or some kind of event and that led to the freedom of a nation from the colonizers and so on. Ours was through a written agreement. And we in the agreement, there are a lot of specific performance. If I'm talking about legal contract, you know, when you sign something, there's specific performance required by both parties to fulfill that agreement.
Right.
Okay. So what we feel in East Malaysia, that we have been sidelined, less developed after 60 years and left behind in the national agenda. And a lot of things have also been overextended in the sense that the kind of concept of Malaysia today is no longer what we envisage or what we signed up for 60 years ago.
Right.
All right. I'm talking about our forefathers. When they signed the agreement, they expect to be a vibrant economic country where all people are united and respect each other and so on. But today, as you mentioned earlier, we still have the 3R. Thank God we don't have the other R, to contend with, okay? Because
in
we don't
East
have,
Malaysia?
In East Malaysia, where we don't have a sultan as another layer as an issue, like here, all right? And so far, for us, we respect the Agong as the country hate them, our monarch. We follow all the Rukun Negara, so to speak, and people still, the young generation probably don't know what Rukun Negara about, but it's basically, it's a pledge designed, I think, in Tun Razak's time, all right, where it embraces what we are all about. If you want to look at something that we can say is Malaysia, that's what we signed up for. It's probably Rukun Negara is the closest.
Right.
Okay.
That's the vision for Malaysia. That's the vision that Sabah and Sarawak, the Sabah and Sarawak territories signed up for under MA63.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about the two R's in the title.
Yes.
And how the two R's are viewed or are lived in East Malaysia, specifically in Sabah. Often, I think the narrative is that Sabahans view themselves or pride themselves for not sharing Malaya's politics and politics of racial and religious rhetoric, right? I want to ask you whether that really is the case. Is the apparent harmony in Sabah, does that go deeper than the surface, or does it mask any underlying tensions between the different ethnic groups?
Okay, I work with a lot of NGOs and like-minded people who share the same values as us in East Malaysia. As you know, East Malaysia, Sabah and Sarawak has been used as a beacon or example of harmony, racial harmony, and so on. Even Hadi of PAS admitted that, you know, if you want to look for examples or harmony, look at East Malaysia. And I always get this question, why, like this morning, I was in conversation with some NGO people, they were saying, tell me, what is the secret of, you know, why we are like we are, you know, peaceful people who respect others and don't have all this baggage of race and religion, which I spoke about. So I think if you look at the early days of Malaya, you don't have that issue also. You know, you look at P. Ramlee movies and all that, which people like to portray, see the dressing style and social behavior is totally different from what it is today. You know, we are going the other way, more negative and more religious-centric.
More conservative.
Yeah, more conservative. So I think race and religion is being played up more in the politics here. Everybody knows that. But why we allow them to continue? You know, we have a lot of issues or laws that can counter these things, but we don't use that law. I mean, Mahathir, for example, can get away, say, old Malay constitution. You know, what is he talking about, you know? And when he talks things like that, of course we are upset in East Malaysia. And of course our leaders will come out with very strong statements. All right, if you want to think it's Malaysia, let's leave. Sabah and Sarawak can leave. We don't need your baggage. We don't need to talk about race and religion, you know, because we are all harmonious there. We don't have these issues, right? Yeah.
Okay, so does it go deeper than that? I guess I want to question or to think through the harmonious living that you point to. What about anti-migrant sentiment? What about a sentiment towards those who are undocumented? Is that equivalent to having having tensions in the social fabric?
Okay, before I come to that, because that's quite a deeper topic, let me come back to the book again. My first introduction chapter and all that, I explained the basis, the foundation of our thinking, okay? Do you know about the Keningau Oak Stone? Have you heard about it?
No, I haven't.
All right, okay. Okay, when Malaysia was formed, our leaders, for some reason and all that, came up with a 20-point safeguard, okay, which everybody knows this in the historical books and documents. And one of the first 20 points, Sarawak is 18 points, but the first point is all the same with Sabah and Sarawak, is freedom of religion. Now, why would our forefathers, you can list a lot of things that taxes, money, development, or whatever you can ask for, but first one is freedom of religion, right? And the Keningau stone is a stone. The native chief of the interior, Keningau, were not assured that what they sign up for will happen. So they had this stone made. It was found in the river. They went through a ceremony to choose a specific stone. And this stone, the inscription of the stone was cast in stone. Now, it's the only stone, as I know, because I go through all the history book and do research, even the Viking stone and all that, where they had their meeting, the first parliament or so. But there's no equivalent in the whole world of the Keningau stone, okay? And the Keningau stone clearly states the first one, the native leaders demanded this freedom of religion. Second, customs and land is theirs, all right? So, and the, we retain our culture and practices. So the Keningau stone, you see, even the schools, they don't know. But if you go to Keningau, it's there.
Right.
And it's in the record because the stone or somehow went missing a few years ago. And Nasri at that time found some money to erect this. They found the stone, but the plate was missing.
Right.
And the is one of the in return for the three requests that we will the natives will show loyalty to the federal government, and that was scratched out. Okay, but the historical stone, okay, this is the only one cast in stone. Our constitution is not cast in stone. The pledge and the promise is cast in stone.
Wow.
So coming back to this question about illegal population, and I just came out from a seminar last week about people talking about education, following United Nations Convention, which we sign up for, human rights, that all undocumented children should be given the right to go to school. I have no problems with that, okay? My question is, you have X number of schools, say 1,000 schools, and you allow a 3 million undocumented population, I'm just giving an estimate, come to school, you know, children come to school of this 3 million, sharing the same resources as Sabahan, who were born and bred there and have the right to be there, and sharing it with undocumented children.
Right, but aren't the undocumented children also born and bred there?
Yes, of course. That's a long story because Sabahans generally blame Mahathir for this Project IC, so-called Project IC, where Blue IC were issued to illegal immigrants, and the demographics has changed for political reasons so that, you know, they become Islam voters to counter
that. It's a long history.
It's long history, okay? But we have to understand our history is not the same as Peninsula. Our history is not the same as Sarawak, okay? We all have different histories.
Okay. All right, that's definitely very interesting. Let's come back to that. We're going to take a very quick break here on Consider This. We'll continue this conversation in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. I'm chatting today to Datuk Dr. Johan Arifin Samad, who just published a book called Unequal Partners. It is written under his pen name, Joe Samad, of which you may know him. He has been an opinion writer for a long time, focusing on issues of inequality, particularly in Sabah. Just before the break, you mentioned how the histories have... histories of Peninsular Malaysia, of Sarawak, of Sabah have lent itself to the unequal development that we see today. Sarawak is particularly interesting to me simply because there was so much talk about a Borneo bloc pushing for more rights for Sabah and the territories of Sabah and Sarawak to correct this imbalance over so many decades. And I do want to ask you about that, whether Sarawak's mindset or slogan is now, GPS is pushing the Sarawak first mentality. What about Sabah? Is Sabah pushing the Sabah first mindset as well?
Well, I think this, when it comes to Malaysia Agreement 1963 and all the other issues associated with it, we are the same mind, okay? Mm. It's just that the NGOs in Sarawak are shouting louder about this, okay? Sabah is a bit less vocal about it, but they still share the same sentiments.
Okay, so in terms of economic disparity, why is it such a stark disparity between Sabah and Sarawak? Why is Sarawak now a high-income state compared to World Bank standards, compared to the very high levels of poverty, one of the poorest states territories in Malaysia? Yes. Why is that so?
Yeah, let's qualify this World Bank. Because a lot of academics after I posted these things also in my social chat disagree with the high-income nation, because even Sarawakians themselves disagree that they're high-income nation, because it doesn't translate into the development that they see. High-income nation should have one of the best infrastructure in the world, which is not, okay? Because the issue of Sabah and Sarawak in terms of infrastructure is still the same. Mm. Okay, so
do you see the disparity in terms of how far Sarawak has come economically compared to Sabah?
I think I have to be frank that Sarawak today is well managed better than and Sabah. And one of the reasons of it is the Sabah politics, which I wrote in my book there. I'm the first one to acknowledge that in Sabah, we have different kind of politics as Sarawak. Mm. Okay, and Sarawak is more tight-knitted under the GPS, all right? And we are sort of stumbling around and trying to emulate Sarawak, which is a pity. But there's a long history of Sabah's politics where, that's why I wrote in there, interference by federal government, you know, UMNO coming in. Do you know that Sabah is the only state that was under the CM rotation? We had 10 CM in 10 years by Mahathir, okay? Sabah is the only state in the whole of Malaysia that has to suffer the indignity of appointing chief minister every 2 years. On a shared base. And then we had the illegal immigration issue, the Blue YC project. You know, we had a Royal Commission investigating and proving that there is such a thing going on, but nobody is brought to book. So we have different issues, and we have border problems. We have the Sulu family claiming, which is in the world court arbitration, and Philippines have not dropped the claims on Sabah. Mm. So we're the only state that has been invaded by foreign entities in recent years, okay? And then we also the only state that is being claimed by a foreign country. So our issues are slightly different from Sarawak.
But sounds so much more intense, therefore should probably require, in terms of equity, probably should require more attention, resources and support from federal government.
Yes.
Has the system of federalism, federal government, failed Sabah?
Oh, obviously, the answer is yes, 100%. Yeah? Because if you look at the current situation, which you all don't follow, our Sabah Law Society is taking the federal government to court on one aspect of the constitution, which says that they have to share 40% of the tax. Whatever is collected in Sabah with the state government. Mm. And for many years, we've been given handouts, you know, which is just pittance to what was agreed in the constitution. So what is happening now, the frustration has come across, and the Sabah Law Society is taking it on behalf of the people of the state, you know, to challenge this.
Okay, so if federalism has failed Sabah, what then do you propose? What I understand what was promised under MA63, but what would devolution of power look like for Sabah?
Yeah, well, Let me answer about the poverty first before I talk about devolution. Okay. I mean, that is one, autonomy is one that we are chasing for, right. Obviously, right? But why is it Sabah, the richest state in Malaysia, in oil resources, and Sarawak too? But let's talk about Sabah. Why they have the highest rate of poverty in the whole of Malaysia?
Right.
After 60 years of Malaysia, right. We're the poorest, but we are rich in oil and gas. Have every intelligent person asked that question? You know, why is that? You know, well, it's very simple. You know, the federal government has taxed us, taken all our resources, and all that, to build KL. All right, that's a fact. And of course, you know, a lot of people here will dispute that, but you know, facts and figures there. We've done a lot of research, how the money is gone and all that. They left us poor. We're in a 12 Malaysia plan now, and look at how many billions they're only giving us to us. And of late, it came out in the newspaper, I think a few days ago, that they'll give us a grant of 300 million, all right, when it should be more under this 40% what is allowed for us in the Constitution. And because of this funding for development and so on, which has not reached us, and of course, along the way, corruption and all that, that has taxed whatever money is given to us. We are in that state now. And one of our, my organization that went to do, for example, outreach programs, I belong to Sabah, which I'm the chairman, the Sabah Advocacy Rights, is a trustee organization. So they were surprised when they went there with a medical team and all that. Some of the people in the interior have never even been to KK. Could you believe that the interior people have not even reached our capital? And you ask them why, they just don't have the money to go go to the capital. Well, that's not important, but they don't have money to go to the nearest hospital.
Yeah.
For example, you have a medical condition and the doctor says, I need to refer back to you a month's time. They're already exhausted whatever cash they have.
There's no follow-up.
There's no follow-up. Yeah. They can't go for the follow-up because, you know, from A to Z, cost them 50 ringgit. 50 ringgit to you might be little, all right? For 50 ringgit for these people who live on subsistence and farming, it's a lot of money.
These aren't new issues. As you said, it's been happening for decades, and yet it still seems to persist. By highlighting it in your book, you're bringing to light some of the real deep discontent that Sabah has had to live through for so many decades. What are you hoping that your book generates? What kind of conversations or action were you hoping through the publication of your book generates? And what is there prospect for change under this new unity government?
Well, as I mentioned to you earlier, when we had a conversation before this, we went on air, I said the book has sort of taken a life of its own. I get a lot of, even somebody texted me last night, they want me to be at the Penang Festival.
Georgetown Festival
to talk about my book and so on. So there are a lot of interested parties suddenly realized that the issues I'm talking about is close to their hearts. Okay, when you write opinion articles, it's just one, you know, and people don't actually see it in totality. So that's why when I put it together,
there's something about it being a compilation.
So when you put it all together, somehow people begin to realize, you know, that there are real issues that he has discussed and brought forward, and is brave enough to talk about it. You know. So the book has already, like I said, found a life of its own, and I'm planning to do it in Sarawak and all that, and Penang and small areas. So I'm using the book now as a talking point, all right? You read it, let's talk about it, okay? And how we can improve Malaysia. I was with a former ambassador yesterday. We had a coffee, and he was eager to meet me. So I was wondering why, because I owe him a book, yes, because he's the one of the person who recommend my book. Is because of, you know, being an ambassador in the world representing Malaysia and coming back to this country with all these issues, of course, he's disillusioned one, depressed, really down, you know, and And he wanted to engage me in discussions. And one of the questions is, what do we do now, you know? And there's no immediate answer.
Yeah, there's no silver bullet, I understand.
Yeah, yeah. So,
but what would you like to see happen, at least as an indication that change is still possible, that progress can happen?
Yeah, so one of the things to a lot of us in NGO is education and welfare. Because if people are well fed, they'll be able to think more in a better environment. Mm-hmm. And I think we don't have enough of these frank conversations anyway, all right? The NGOs are well ahead of the government. Okay, they know what's ideals. They know all kinds of branches of society. That's why we were talking this morning, even things like heritage. It's not only medical or economy. Yeah. There are many segments, even Islam. You know, there are groups of Islam-based who are so concerned where religion is heading today, right? Mm. So it's not enough we follow the five pillars of Islam, sembahyang lima kali, puasa, and so Mecca and all that. What else do they want out of us from religion? You know, that we have to dress like Hadi, we have to behave like him, you know? Is that what kind of things that you expect from us? You know? Anyway, most of the Islamists today are very external, all right? They're not internal. Uh-huh. Okay, they externalize the whatever aura or what, you know. But religion is mostly internal, your goodness of your heart, and you share that with people, and this is what East Malaysians are talking about, you know.
Right. Mm. Thank you so much for being on the show today. Yeah. I appreciate your time. That was my conversation with Datuk Dr. Johan Arifin Samad. And that wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.